We're talking about sexual abuse in the clergy on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a difficult conversation, and this hour could be disturbing, so please take care as we talk about child abuse and our state's Catholic clergy accused of sex abuse. That list is growing. Meanwhile, Wisconsin is not unique. USA Today Network investigated more than 1,200 former priests, Catholic brothers, and Catholic school officials accused of sex abuse. Most never face criminal charges. What are your thoughts on the recent investigations of former priests being accused of sexual abuse? What would justice look like to you? We're at 800-642-1234. Lindsay Schnell is a national correspondent for USA Today based in Portland, Oregon. She recently published a report about Catholic sex abuse and what happens to accused priests. Lindsay, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
How did you go about determining the number of priests accused of sexual abuse throughout the U.S., considering there's not a central list that currently exists?
Yeah, we wrote about that in our article. You know, there have been releases from the church, from various dioceses and archdioceses in the last 2 years. It happened a little sporadically since the scandal first came into public view in 2002 after the Boston Globe's explosive pieces. But we really started to see releases from the church after the Pennsylvania grand jury report, which was published August of 2018. But as you said, there's no central list. What it means to be credibly accused varies from diocese to diocese. So we worked off both lists that the church had released and then also Bishop Accountability, a website that lists accused priests, many of whom have died. And we wanted to get to 1,000. We thought that was a really good number. We thought that could provide a really good sample size. We wound up, you know, doing backgrounds on more than 1,200, and then we built a database of, it was almost 700. It was 699 last known addresses. And from there, we decided to go knock on doors.
When you knocked on doors, what did you ask? What were you seeking?
So first, of course, we confirmed that the person living there was the former priest. And then we first asked them about the allegations. You know, how would they respond? We had done a lot of research on every individual whose door we went and knocked. And then we asked them, what were they doing now? Did they receive a pension from the church? Did their neighbors know about their past? What did they think about statute of limitation reform that's going on across the country in various states? Did they believe that their neighbors had a right to know about their past? Were they around children regularly? Questions like that. And what I was surprised by is dozens of them spoke to us.
That they didn't close the door.
Right, exactly. For me personally, I went and I made the first knock. I was just north of Seattle in Oak Harbor, Washington. And when I knocked, I knew right away when this man answered the door, Barry Ashwell, that it was him because I had read a lot on him and I had seen photos. And he told me, I don't want to talk, but he stood there with the door open for almost 20 minutes. So we kept talking. And I think that happened to a lot of people. But for others, they were open. And not all of them talked to us. Some of them did close the door in our face, but dozens of them did speak, and I thought that was fascinating.
Lindsay Schnell is with us. She's a national correspondent for USA Today, and she recently published an investigation about sexual abuse in the clergy. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. Lindsay, you went all over the country, you and your colleagues, talked with neighbors and school officials, employers, church leaders, and victims. Were they aware that a priest accused of sexual abuse was living near them or living nearby?
No, most of them were not. And so what's important to remember is that, you know, the only way you can get on a sex offender registry is if you are convicted in a criminal case. sometimes it's part of a plea deal. Other times it's from a judgment passed down by a judge or by a jury. A lot of these men were never criminally charged. We know that it takes survivors decades after the alleged abuse to come forward. And often by then, statute of limitation laws have expired. So there's no course of criminal action or civil action that you can take. So many of these men were acknowledged by the church as abusers, but then just sort of sent along their way. And the question we were trying to answer was, did the church essentially wash their hands of them once these men left, or were they keeping tabs on them? There was not, again, there's not a central rule or a central list, but what our reporting shows is that most of the diocese and archdiocese did wash their hands of them, and now these men are living openly next to schools and daycares and families and without any sort of oversight from either the church or local authorities.
This year, Wisconsin started releasing names of credibly accused clergy members. How does a diocese decide who goes on the accused list?
That varies from diocese to diocese, which is part of what survivors groups and victims advocates have pushed back on and have been vocal about, that there's no central rule, and so it can be all over the place. I cannot speak to what each individual diocese in Wisconsin does, but it's safe to say that they're different, which is based on, you know, which survivors groups and victims advocates would say is not okay.
What states do you see law enforcement, state government, taking more of an active role, regardless of statute of limitations?
Well, I think statute of limitation reform is where it starts. That's what matters. You can't, the authorities cannot get involved in something that when someone wasn't charged. So you have seen, we've seen states across the country both reform statute of limitation laws, but also, you know, after the Pennsylvania grand jury report got released in August of 2018, since then, 21 other state attorneys general have launched their own investigations. And so that's one step. Some states are doing statute of limitation reform and don't have a grand jury or AG investigation. Some states just have an AG investigation. Some states have both, and there's overlap. And, you know, then you see New York is an example of that. They passed the Child Victims Act, where survivors can come forward and file claims decades after the fact. And then, if I remember correctly, they are also currently, their attorney general is investigating the church.
As we wrap up here, going back to the doors, knocking on doors, talking with priests, did they express any remorse in any of these conversations?
In the conversations that I had with priests, they did not. And then in the conversations many of my colleagues had, they did not. And I thought that that was shocking, that right after being so surprised that so many of them spoke with us, the second most surprising thing to me was the lack of remorse. The person whose door I knocked on north of Seattle, you know, when he kept saying, I'm done with this, I'm done with this, I've moved on. And I said, well, do you think your victims would say the same thing, that they're done with this? And he retorted, you know, I've had it with victims. I was shocked by that. And not everyone had that callous of a response, but many of them wanted to know, why were we asking questions about something that happened so long ago?
Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, of course. Thank you for having me.
Lindsay Schnell, a national correspondent for USA Today. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about clergy sex abuse on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and please be aware that this hour's conversation contains content of a sexual nature involving children. It may be disturbing to you. It may not be suitable for everyone who's with us on this Tuesday, so please take care. The Catholic Church has paid tens of millions of dollars in settlements to sexual abuse survivors in Wisconsin, but the full picture of priest sexual abuse in the state is just now emerging. Wisconsin Watch, which is the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, it's verified at least 170 priests with credible allegations of sexual abuse between our state's five dioceses and many religious orders. But as WPR's Bram Sable-Smith reports, naming the accused is only a start.
When Patty Galger Marchant was in second grade in 1965, a young priest at her Monona, Wisconsin parochial school befriended her family. He'd come over for dinner, go drinking with her father, and at school, he chose Marchant to bring him his daily milk.
He sexually abused me in his office right off the gymnasium.
She was only seven. Marchant says the abuse lasted for about a month. It was traumatic. She calls it a mind trip. She had to make her first confession to this priest, Lawrence Trainer.
So I had to say, I'm sorry, Father, for I have sinned to the man who was violating me.
Marchant repressed the memories for over 25 years. She became a psychotherapist, got married, started a family. Then in 1991, her own daughter turned seven, and the memories of abuse came flooding back. That's when she picked up the phone.
I called the Madison Diocese and said, I'd like to speak with somebody about Lawrence Trainer, and they immediately went silent.
Marchant wanted to warn the diocese about an abusive priest. Instead, she was ensnared in a legal battle that ended in a six-figure settlement for her, but, she says, with little closure. Taking on the church felt like enduring another wave of violence, not just for her, but her parents.
They lived in fear of being targeted or blamed. And it wasn't their fault or my fault that this happened. He chose us. He knew we were vulnerable. So we were victims of a crime. We were victims of a crime.
In 2003, the Madison Diocese admitted to paying $1.6 million to 19 survivors of priest sexual abuse. Lawrence Trainer was publicly listed as one of four priests with documented allegations. But even then, Marchant says no one from the church ever even apologized for what she endured. But something changed this summer. The Madison Diocese got a new bishop, Donald Hine. Marchant was expecting to be placated. Instead, he agreed to meet her.
The meeting certainly allowed me to apologize to her on behalf of the church.
Bishop Hine.
And to say those words of apology seems so inadequate in face of the enormity of what she experienced, and yet they're important.
Hine says in the past, church officials were advised by lawyers, so they responded to people like Marchant in a legal way.
When, in fact, I think what victims were really looking for, are looking for, is a pastoral response, you know, a human response.
A pastoral response. Hine says he's met with several survivors since he became bishop, and he tries to bring that human dimension to each one.
Certainly, my door and heart are always open for speaking with victims as they may feel the need to come forward.
Marchant says Hine was the first person from the church to tell her the anger that she and her family felt was warranted.
To be heard and validated for something we've been carrying mostly on our own for so long was massive.
Marchant says there's still work to be done. She'd like to see the bishop speak about abuse from the pulpit and offer a place for the people and families harmed to go to talk about what happened. But for now, she says, a bishop open to meaningful conversations is a good start. Bram Sable-Smith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The story is part of a partnership between WPR and Wisconsin Watch, and it provides a framework to talk about this on the Ideas Network. You can join in at any point. Are you a member of a church that's under investigation for possible abuse? How do you feel about that? Do you think Wisconsin should investigate how the Catholic Church has handled sex abuse complaints? We're at 800-642-1234. Patricia Gallagher Marchant is a psychotherapist in Milwaukee. She joins us from our studios in Milwaukee. Patricia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. I really welcome this opportunity to speak about what's so incredibly difficult for many to speak about.
to hear you say the words at the top of Bram's piece that you had to make your first confession to this priest who sexually abused you. What was that like?
Well, he was a very charismatic young priest. He had just graduated from the seminary, like maybe a year before he joined the church that my family was members at. And it's tremendously confusing. It's difficult to describe as a child, to hold an awareness that an adult is so mean and controlling, and it's a mind trip. And yet we had to follow these rules. I mean, those of us that grew up through Catholic education in the 60s, especially and prior, it was a very rigid environment. So we as little kids were to follow rules, line up to get a drink of water and line up and be quiet in church, and we were little. To speak to this man who was clearly, from my point of view, crazy. I just knew as a little one that he was off.
He instructed you to bring him a carton of milk and instructed the other kids?
How it was presented, I was in second grade, and he chose children to bring him a carton of milk at the start of the school day. And nobody questioned that. The principal of the school, Sister Mary, it was my turn to take him a carton of milk. And she would hand it to me. I would go to the kitchen, or I showed up at the kitchen at the cafeteria and had to walk it down a sidewalk to his office, which was separate from the school, adjacent to the gymnasium. And he groomed me. I knew was nervous and anxious, and I could, inside of myself, I felt highly suspicious and uncomfortable and wondering. A super smart, intuitive little girl, three brothers and an older sister, I knew how to fight my way through many hardships already. So I was pretty astute, and I felt caught. I just felt caught. And what he did, the invasive, the absolutely horrific, violent, sexual violent, overwhelming harm, I repressed until I was 35 years old, which is very, very common for victims of sexual crime. So
you had a daughter who was turning 7 years old. Do you think that was a trigger of these memories?
Yes. As a psychotherapist myself, and having done a lot of my own therapy, early on in my life when I was in high school is when I initially had symptoms. I was highly anxious and overwhelmed and didn't really know why. And my astute therapists, I've had two very powerful healing professionals in my life who just both said, when you're ready to remember, Patty, you will. They knew it was PTSD, that I had repressed memories. I knew too. So when Angela, our oldest daughter, reached the age of 7, I'm married, happily married, proudly, with 3 young adult children. And when our oldest daughter reached the age of 7, my unconscious mind brought forward these overwhelming memories. I had a dream, called my mom, and said, who was that priest who invited me into his office? And my mother remembered that Lawrence Trainer had chosen me to bring him this carton of milk. And so at that time, in 1991, I was very established in my career and, as I've mentioned, did therapy work myself. So I was compelled to call the Madison Diocese because I wanted to make sure children and families were protected I wondered if he still had access to children. And when I called, he had they had already removed his faculties in 1989.
So he couldn't say Mass.
Yeah, that means he couldn't say Mass. But they quickly went into a highly defensive posture. And I knew I was up against a major feat of truth-telling. And what surprised me was they already had plenty of evidence that he was harming children, but they challenged me and my husband with hiring four attorneys, and we were forced to hire one to bring this truth forward.
Talking with psychotherapist Patricia Gallagher Marchant, who stays with us from Milwaukee. You can join in 800-642-1234. What are the next steps here in finding justice? Are you in the process of healing over clergy sex abuse from your childhood? There's space for you. Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Back after this news update on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And a note on coverage here, the public hearings of the House impeachment inquiry into President Trump continue this morning. You can hear live coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're carrying it on our NPR News and Classical Music Network starting at 8. That's live coverage of the hearings beginning in 25 minutes on the NPR News and Classical Music Network and online at WPR.org. Right now, we're talking about sex abuse in the Catholic Church. It is a sensitive conversation, so please use your discretion. More than 11,000 accusations of childhood sexual abuse by Catholic priests and brothers have been made across the country since the 70s. We're looking at the situation in Wisconsin, where the number of accused priests now stands at roughly 170. Has the church's handling of sexual abuse claims made you feel differently about the church? How should the Vatican respond? Join in 800-642-1234. We've been talking with psychotherapist Patricia Gallagher Marchant, who stays with us from Milwaukee. Now let's bring in Terry McKiernan, founder and president of bishopaccountability.org. Terry, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much, Kate. Good to be with you.
Pope Francis, earlier this year, issued the first law requiring that church officials around the world report cases of clergy sexual abuse. What kind of impact has this had on this crisis?
I think that people are reassured that Pope Francis, after a lot of mixed signals, has finally, I think probably because of the crisis in Chile, he's been forced to confront it at last. And the provision to report is certainly a step in the right direction, although, of course, the reporting that he's talking about is internal reporting.
This is self-reporting.
Exactly, and reporting within the church, whereas, as you and I and your listeners know, reporting to civil and criminal authorities is absolutely essential in these matters, and that's not something that the Pope has touched. He's also taken a step in the direction of accountability for the bishops, who had really been left out of the system entirely. But in that area also, I think the jury is really out still.
All five of our state's dioceses have launched investigations to figure out who has been credibly accused of sexual abuse. Terry, is that something you're seeing among dioceses straight across the country?
Yeah, you know, in fact, the two dioceses in Wisconsin that still haven't come out with reports, Superior and La Crosse, are really behind the curve at this point. It's in the last year we've seen over 100 dioceses and superiors of religious orders have come up with some kind of a list accounting at least in some way for the miserable performance we've seen over the last 60 or 70 years. So it's certainly good that we have lists now from Green Bay, Madison, and Milwaukee, but Superior and La Crosse are still out, and we need those lists from them. And I think that it's good to have these lists, but they're certainly not all created equal. If you go to the Milwaukee list, for example, and compare it to the database on our website, you'll see that there are about 50 names missing because Milwaukee has not included, and this goes back to Archbishop Dolan, priests of religious orders who have abused children. And that's happening on the bishop's watch, and I think it's really important for the bishops to account for everything, not account in a selective way.
Patricia, let's pick up when you went to the Madison Diocese explaining your situation, what you had experienced. How were you received?
This was in 1991, so, you know, a decade before the Boston scandal. They were highly defensive and impersonal and, frankly, cold. I felt I was treated as a threatening person to them. And, you know, clearly I had a story that was incredibly painful, and my intent at the time was to open up a conversation about sexual abuse and the horror of it and the importance of taking action, especially to stop men who sexually abuse children, which we know pedophiles, men who have issues around attraction with young children, need treatment. And what's appalling, what was appalling to me is the need to get or find treatment for their fellow priests that were in trouble was not even out front and center. As a therapist myself, it's just appalling. To this day, we're not focused on the treatment of this and the need for intervention, both for the victims and their families as well as the men who harm children. And this is a felony. Sexually abusing a child is a felony, and the civil authorities absolutely have to be involved. The police need to be involved immediately. The church cannot police themselves. They continue to take a position of wanting to keep these stories more internal than external and allowing, you know, the public to know, which is absolutely ludicrous and wrong.
Patricia, you wanted to face the priests who abused you, and you wanted to have that sit-down conversation. What did you want out of that conversation?
I wanted to meet. I didn't want a courtroom fiasco, an impersonal, lawyered-up courtroom fiasco. My family and I, my dad was a friend of Lawrence Trainor's. He had befriended my family. So we wanted to speak to him directly, and we did. We had an organized, coordinated meeting with him in my attorney's conference room with their four attorneys and my one attorney, and my father and my husband and myself were able to really confront him about the harm he created and caused me and my whole family. That was an incredible healing opportunity for us. We also wanted to meet with the bishops and the leaders in the diocese at the time, and we did that as well, because we felt, and I know to this day, that one-to-one conversation and in-person conversation is where real change happens, followed by the support of the law, of course, when criminal behavior is in place. But if we want real change, we need to sit down with each other, and that's what we did in the 90s. What was painful for us was, and for me especially, was the lack of empathy, the lack of real personal tending to us. We were looked at as adversaries and, you know, troublemakers, essentially, when we truly were victims. I mean, sexual abuse is a horrific violation, and it's incredibly difficult to face in recovery. In the grieving process, it's a deep grieving process that goes on for years. So what these men, these priests, have taken from young children and families is huge. And for them to continue to minimize this issue and want to quickly push it aside and hope it's over quickly and that these cases are years ago is, again, another horrible defensive maneuver. We need to bring sexual abuse out in the open. We need to reach as a culture to talk about what's difficult. We need to be available to children and families that have been harmed, and that includes within the church and within their walls. They can't get a pass, from my point of view. My hope is they don't get a pass.
We're talking with Patricia Gallagher Marchant, who is a psychotherapist in Milwaukee, Terry McKiernan, the founder and president of bishopaccountability.org, and you. Do you think the church should be left to investigate itself, or do you want to see more secular investigations taking place? How do you want to see lawmakers engaging on this issue? Join in 800-642-1234. Terry, there are internal audits, yearly audits, that the church does. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops had issued a charter to have dioceses do audits, making sure they're reporting abuse to law enforcement and being more open and transparent. What kind of compliance are you seeing here with this charter?
On the surface, the compliance seems to be good, but I think the necessities that Patricia just laid out are really in many ways still not being addressed. Again, you know, what we're seeing in those audits are really self-audits of the mechanisms rather than independent assessments of the performance. And there's a huge difference between those two goals. It is a revealing moment at the not the last bishops' meeting, but the one before it, when the bishops were discussing their mechanism for holding bishops accountable. And one of the bishops suggested that they ought to do an audit of that process to make sure it was working well. And that idea was rejected out of hand. So I think we're still finding not the horrible experience that Patricia had in the early 90s, but I think still a very settled culture of denial and minimization and lack of transparency. You know, we have documents from the Milwaukee Archdiocese, but we know very little about how this has played out in the other dioceses in Wisconsin, and we really need to know that. I personally feel that the Attorney General needs to get involved in Wisconsin, as that officer has in many other states now, and do a full investigation where he has command of the files and can release the documents and the real underlying information here that we're not going to get at through self-reporting and self-audits.
Terry McKiernan, founder and president of bishopaccountability.org, psychotherapist Patricia Gallagher Marchant with us. She works with the group called Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. You can join in, 800-642-1234. How do you want your diocese to respond? How do you want to see churches handle reports of sexual abuse? Should state lawmakers, local law enforcement get involved? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the past year, some dioceses and religious orders have for the first time listed their accused clergy of child sexual abuse. In other parishes, though, the decades of silence continues. This hour's conversation is about stories of childhood sexual abuse and the clergy, and it's not suitable for everyone. So please be mindful of that. Please take care. Terry McKiernan is with us. He's founder and president of bishopaccountability.org. Psychotherapist Patricia Gallagher Marchant stays with us and in our Milwaukee studios this morning. Patricia, one of the poignant things that came out of that meeting with the priest is, and the bishops, is that they were a bit incensed when you said, well, what do you want? Do you want an 800 line or some way to call in? And I think it was, you said, actually, yes. Take us to that moment.
Yeah, the request I had in 1991 was that the church open up an office. As a psychotherapist, I know that children and families who have been impacted by sexual abuse really, really hide out and stay silent. And I was insistent with them, saying, don't you feel some level of responsibility? Open up an office. Make yourself available to talk to people that have been harmed around the country. This, again, is in 1991, and I was naively hoping and wishing they would be more than gracious and wanting to be helpful. But the bishop that we met with very flippantly said, in very defensive reaction, said, what do you want, a 1-800 clergy sexual abuse line? And I said, great idea, yeah. Create a 1-800 line. Folks can call in. They can reach out for the help that they desperately need. But they were making light and fun of my wish and our wish to do something constructive, to move forward, proactive, to help those folks that have been hurt and harmed and healed. Because the truth is, in our culture, 1 out of 3 girls by the age of 18 and 1 out of 6 boys by the age of 18 will be sexually abused. And it's one of the most underreported crimes. So with those statistics, sexual abuse is part of our culture. And it's also obviously clearly within the church ranks as well. We need, as a culture, the church is clearly confronted now to open their doors and start facing the reality that they're part of our human family. They've been impacted like we are, and they need to do something about it. My real focus now is on restorative justice action and offering healing opportunities once again in some form is essential, I think, to move forward.
Let's bring in Greg now, joining us from Green Bay. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. I am just very concerned as to why it is even a question if law enforcement should be involved. I think that it should be investigated from a federal level, a state level, municipal level, and globally. The fact that this has been happening and has been known to have been happening for years, has been talked about, documented, movies, people make reports, and still now it's up to the church to decide what to do with their child abusers. It's preposterous to me that this is even a debate.
Greg, thank you.
I cannot believe it.
Thank you for the call. Terry McKiernan, there should be something much more orchestrated in Greg's mind here from law enforcement at all levels.
I think Greg is absolutely right. One insight into the problem that he's describing is that the bishop's lists in Wisconsin that have come out so far name 102 accused priests. My organization has counted 184. If 10% of the priests are guilty of this crime, and let's remember it is a crime, the number really ought to be for Wisconsin something around 400. So we have so far to go to have a complete understanding of the abuse crisis in the Catholic Church in Wisconsin, let alone justice for the people who have suffered. And that, I think, is where Patricia's emphasis on restorative justice also comes in. This isn't simply a matter of criminal prosecution and retribution. We also need to rebuild the lives of the people who have been harmed and reform the church, ultimately. But I agree with Greg that it has to begin with criminal action in cases where crimes have been committed.
Let's bring in Paula now in La Crosse with thoughts. Hi, Paula.
Oh, hi. I guess going off what the gentleman just said, I feel terrible saying this, but I don't understand the absurdity of, if you truly are a Christian person, you are good, and how the Catholic people that are still within the Catholic religion, why don't they stand up? I guess my question is, and this is horrible, I know to say, but can the Catholic Church really be reformed? You look at the, from way up, this has been going on, and this is not a few bad apples. I'm not naive. I know in other religious orders this is happening, and it's probably some women who are being abused, but I mean, can it truly be reformed? Should these parishioners that are in the Catholic Church stand up and fight for reform?
Yeah, Paula, I want to pause right there and bring in Patricia with this question. Patricia, what is, if I may ask, your relationship with the church today? How did it change?
I'm in and out. I took a break from the Catholic Church. I really do. I've enjoyed some of the rituals within the church, the music. I'm reminded lots of my family, especially my mother. She was a devout Catholic, but we're outsiders. We're watching. We're hoping and wishing, as was stated, that the Catholics within the church need to scream and ask for transparency and justice, bring outsiders in when children are harmed or at risk. No questions asked. The Catholic people, the masses of people need to open their eyes to the darkness that is within their ranks, in their midst. Darkness lives next to them. Wake up and let's join each other to create safe places and safe places of worship.
You ended up receiving an apology from the bishop on behalf of the church for the abuse and the trauma you suffered. How much of a difference can an apology make in the healing process?
Yes, I had a really powerful meeting with Bishop Hying in July. I felt compelled after the Pope's position this last year to go back to Madison and deal with my family, my history within the Madison Diocese. And I was struck by his deep kindness and personal tending to me and my husband. It was the first time we were treated with empathy. It was very, very moving, and he seems to understand the complexity of the issue and what he's up against. I know he's one person, but my hope and prayer is that the leaders within the church, that other bishops are willing to stick their necks out and do what's right. We need leaders within to take this issue seriously, like I believe Bishop Hying has and will. But he's one leader among thousands around the world.
Patricia, thank you for joining us and sharing your story.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the opportunity.
Patricia Gallagher-Marchant is a psychotherapist in Milwaukee who joined us from our studios there. And Terry, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much. Really a pleasure to be with you.
Terry McKiernan is founder and president of bishopaccountability.org. Just ahead, we talk to the second woman to win a Nobel Prize for Economics about her latest research on alleviating global poverty. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.